Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, the normally hot summer home buying season has been somewhere between lackluster and anemic. But what does the data tell us about the local market as we prepare to head into fall? Also this morning, this will be remembered as the summer of natural disasters, one right after the other from coast to coast. We often talk about preparedness for your home and your family, but how ready is your business to weather the storm? And late summer is a special time to enjoy the outdoors with September programs and activities from the Hancock Park District. Michelle Rumschlag will tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Tuesday, August 25th, 2026. WalletHub is out with another list, and once again, Ohio is near the very bottom. But this time around, whether that is good or bad depends on how you perceive the numbers. Because you see, this is a list of the hardest working states in America. And the facts are that Americans put in an average of 1,800 hours a year. This is according to the World Economic Forum. For comparison, that is 468 hours more per year than many Europeans spend working. So, again, whether you consider that a good thing or a bad thing may be a matter of perception, but there is certainly an argument to be made that working a little less and spending a little more time just living your life is a good thing. And just to drive the point home here, even when given the chance to take time off, many Americans won't. Nearly half of workers in this country do not expect to use all of their allotted vacation days. So, when you're looking at the list of the hardest working Americans, is that a good thing or a bad thing? So to determine where Americans work the hardest, WalletHub compared all 50 states across 10 key indicators, 10 key metrics, ranging from average work week hours to the share of workers with multiple jobs to the average leisure time spent per day. South and North Dakota are numbers 1 and 2 on the list, respectively. Those Dakotans, boy, they are a hardworking bunch. Then that's followed by Alaska, Hawaii, and Wyoming, rounding out the top five. Those are the hardest working states, according to WalletHub. Ohio, on the other hand, ranks 47th out of 50, ahead of only New Jersey, Oregon, and Michigan at the bottom of the list. So, now when it comes to Michigan, I'll look at that and say, oh, that must be because they're lazy. But when Ohio is 47th, I'm thinking, maybe we just have a better work-life balance. So again, there is no question that the hard work ethic of Americans has brought about the creation of many successful businesses and innovations and, one of the world's top economies. There's no question. But overworking can take a toll. Now, Ohio 47th on the list. It is also worth noting that Ohio is the state where people are least likely to leave vacation time unused. So we are the least likely to leave those vacation days on the table. Again, make of that what you will, but it is interesting nonetheless. Speaking of working hard, these days you got to work harder and harder and harder just to make ends meet. And here's a story that drives that point home. Struggling Americans, according to a new LendingTree report, struggling Americans are increasingly using buy now, pay later microloans to cover basic necessities like groceries and gas to get to work, yeah, and just to put food on the table. Now, this is not what buy now, pay later was designed for. But this report found nearly one third of buy now, pay later services, people who rely, one third of people who rely on buy now, pay later services rely on them for essentials. More than half saying that they could not make ends meet without them. That is a 25% jump in the number of people who said that compared to last year. The Federal Reserve found that one in five Americans used buy now, pay later for food purchases recently, and one in four users carry three or more active buy now, pay later loans simultaneously, with nearly half of users struggling to make on-time payments. They fear that buy now, pay later has become so common that many consumers don't even really think of it as debt anymore. But it most certainly is. It is money that has been advanced to you that you have to pay back. That is the definition of debt. So if you're among those who don't consider it debt, think again. And I think, again, it really raises the question of whether the problem is over-reliance on buy now, pay later, or the unaffordable cost of the things people feel that they have to use those buy now, pay later services for. There's something to think about. Kind of interesting. And again, it goes back to what we were talking about. Are we hard workers because that's our work ethic? Are we hard workers just because we feel we have to, or we have the proper work-life balance? It all ties together, and that's just interesting stuff. Couple of other items here. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This is a thing again. I don't know if you happen to see this story. I saw it on the news last night. New York City police are investigating another sewer incident following a viral video on social media. Footage posted online Friday shows three people in overalls and headlamps emerging from a manhole at 32nd Street and 7th Avenue in New York City. The person who posted the clip told NBC News that they took the video last Tuesday around 4 in the morning, and just some random guy climbing out of a manhole, climbing out of the sewer in New York. A spokesperson for the NYPD says that they are looking into the incident. However, no arrests have been made. You remember a few months ago, there were a number of videos of people popping out of the sewers that made the rounds. And people were wondering, what in the world is going on? And then it went away, and now apparently it is back. The original incident prompted a separate police probe that found no threat to the public or damage to the sewer system. But officials are saying this is not only against the law, it is incredibly dangerous to be wandering around in the sewers for any number of reasons. A number of reasons why I would not be doing that, but apparently these people are. I don't understand. Hopefully we'll get to the bottom of this very soon, but a weird story. Weird story, and it is back. Apparently people are just too bored in New York City. They need more things. Maybe they need to spend more time at work. That's what they need. They need to spend more time at work. That's what it is. And lastly here, among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, and this actually is quite serious. We have known for many years about the issues of body dysmorphia and the disorders that it can lead to, bulimia, anorexia, you know, those kind of things. And when we talk about those disorders, those eating disorders, they generally are more common among girls, especially teenage girls, young women, girls and young women, than they are males. Well, there is a lesser known body image disorder that has been dubbed bigorexia. I guess the clinical name is muscle dysmorphia, that is increasingly affecting boys and young men. And this is worth knowing about. Kara Becker of Newport Healthcare describes it as a psychological condition and type of disorder which involves a distorted self-image that focuses specifically on muscle size and physical appearance, whereas anorexia and bulimia are disorders where, again, primarily females look at themselves and think they need to be thinner, they need to be skinnier, and so they just lose an unhealthy amount of weight. This is a case where young men, boys and young men, look in the mirror and they think, I need to be more muscular. I need to beef up. And so they engage in activities that can lead to a distorted self-image based on muscle size, physical appearance. A study in 2019 found 22% of adolescent boys engaged in muscular-oriented disordered eating behaviors. So between 1 in 5, 1 in 4 engaged in this. So this is pretty common. Experts point to social media as a major driver. And again, just like we see driving factors in anorexia being all of these super skinny models, in society, in this case, men's bodies being on display more than ever online, and these quote perfect men's bodies, and this is what they're trying to emulate. And just like with female models influencing young girls, the images of so-called perfect men's bodies represent unrealistic, unattainable, and often unhealthy habits, or unhealthy ideals. Warning signs. These are the things to watch for. Parents, take note. Warning signs include obsessive exercise, rigid dietary habits, and social withdrawal. Parents are urged to limit social media, have open conversations about what's normal and healthy, and seek professional help early if you are concerned. And I wanted to bring this up. I saw this on the Newswire yesterday, and this is something that can be very serious. So don't take this lightly. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Tuesday morning started.
Ohio News Now. The father of a Findlay man involved in a nearly seven-hour police standoff questioning how officers handled the incident. Cops say 52-year-old Michael Thompson pointed a gun at an officer during the February standoff, which he live-streamed. After attempts to communicate with Thompson failed, officers used chemical gas and eventually a police canine to take him into custody. Thompson's father says his son had recently undergone major surgery and was unable to speak.
He was scared. Mike had been through a 10-and-a-half-hour surgery 1 week prior.
Michael Thompson died from cancer complications in June. His father says he now plans to file a complaint against Findlay police. A motorcyclist seriously injured following a crash in rural Putnam County. The Ohio State Highway Patrol says the rider went off State Route 634 in Perry Township Saturday night and struck a telephone pole. He was taken to a local hospital before being flown to another hospital for further treatment. Troopers believe alcohol was a factor. The rider was not wearing a helmet. An advocacy group is calling attention to high childcare prices in Ohio. Tasha Booker with Action for Children says the cost of daycare for kids in the Buckeye State has reached a crisis level. A family with an infant and a toddler can spend about a third of their income on childcare, according to Booker. The Ohio State Chamber of Commerce has been working with state officials to develop some programs and cost-cutting measures for early schooling and child supervision. I'm Patrick Johnson reporting.
Our cover story this morning, depending on whose numbers you're looking at and how you look at them, what is normally a hot summer home buying season has this year fallen somewhere between lackluster and anemic. So what does the data tell us about the local market? Here we are joined by Brian Witta, Coldwell Banker, Flag City. And Brian, I know we have talked about this before. We look at the national numbers which come out. We got some numbers last week. We'll get today new home sales, the latest new home sales numbers, the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. These are national numbers. which may or may not reflect what is happening in the local market.
Right, absolutely. And I feel like every time we talk about this, I'm telling you how rosy it is here and how gloomy it is nationally.
Yeah.
We really are kind of a microcosm here.
So let me go through some of the numbers that we got last week. People may have heard these in the headlines, and you tell me how concerned we should be about this, or how this impacts, or whether these things impact the local market. The pending home sales, this was the big number last week that made headlines. Pending home sales for the month of July came in down 2.3% compared to the previous month. That is the lowest since January. And as we know, January, typically not a real big month for home sales. July is supposed to be. So naturally, that got a lot of people's attention. It was much lower than what was anticipated.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's always a blip before school starts. We always experience that locally, and realtors, you know, we tend to go. And then all of a sudden things like that happen. We look at each other and say, is this it? This is how it ends. There's nothing going on. What's happening?
Yeah.
But the reality is there's always a blip before school starts. This year it happened a little earlier than what it usually does, but there are more buyers starting to come back in the market now that the county schools go back in today. And of course, you know, that's going to shift people's mindset again once we get back into that routine.
Now, they did note that in the Midwest, there was a year-over-year gain. The year-over-year numbers were also lower. But here in the Midwest, we're actually seeing a little bit stronger numbers than we did a year ago. Is that reflected here locally as well?
It is. You know, I think no matter which agent you would speak with, they would all tell you right now we are quite busy. The piece that concerns me in all the data that's come out is this split with the Fed, this 9-3 split on the vote on whether we raise interest rates. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of an unknown, depending on what happens with inflation.
Yeah. Again, talking about interest rates, I did see a piece, and I think it was in Fortune magazine. They pointed out that Treasury bonds hit a 19-year high last week. And that has a lot to do with what happens with mortgage rates, what the bond rate is. And that has to be a bit concerning, because we're already in a spot where a lot of home buyers think that rates are excessively high, even though really historically they're not.
Right. And to your point, you know, the 10-year Treasury hit 4.72 yesterday. That's up 0.44 from a year ago. Mm-hmm. So is that an indicator that we're going to see the rates go up? It could be. But even at 0.25%, which is what the 9-3 split vote was, even at 0.25%, I think most buyers have gotten to the point where they're understanding the point you just made a minute ago. Rates are not ridiculous. We were teased for years with an artificially deflated interest rate, and it's just now coming back to where it ought to be.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, there was also a report from Redfin, which said that you're seeing the pendulum has swung. And we've talked about this before, from a buyer's market to a seller's market. There's more sellers in the market, according to Redfin, than there are buyers right now by like 51.3%. So it's not a huge split, but it is swinging that way. And that is... And that is kind of changing the equilibrium, I guess.
We do see that locally here. There is more of a balance within the county. You know, I have a system that pulls what it calls a market action index. And within that action index, the needle sits almost dead center right now. In the peak parts of the year where there's more buyers out there, we see that needle move different directions. But at this time of year, for it to be hitting dead center, I would say those numbers nationally are indicative here of what's going on. Buyers might have a little more power to negotiate. Sellers may not be totally driving the bus. They're at least steering it.
Yeah.
But they may not be hitting the accelerator the way they were, especially during COVID.
Yeah, that 51.3 number seems to indicate that it's pretty balanced, just leaning a little bit towards sellers. You bring up the good point. Again, it's what you're used to. And I guess as it relates to what we saw during the COVID years, we also saw a big spike in prices, in home prices. Has that cooled?
It has. Yeah. You can't price a home with the COVID pricing that we experienced for so long. You know, when we went up on average 20% during COVID, that was a significant jump. And we just don't, sellers, you don't have that power anymore. Buyers are more discerning. They're negotiating differently. So yeah, we have seen a big change in that direction.
That's not to say that this is not a good time to list the home, or is it, if you're thinking of selling?
So the irony in this is I continue to hear people say now's not the time. I hear consumers say now's not the time.
Yeah.
I just listed a home in Findlay where another agent told them you're never going to sell this home. I think it's worth about $250. I just sold it at $299. So the reality is the data always drives it. And if you're watching the market statistics, if you're working with someone that understands the data, you're in a better position to be successful. You have to watch it. It's black and white.
So again, in that same Redfin report, they were talking about record low demand right now. I guess what's the message to somebody who might be hearing that and thinking, golly, what do I do? I'm thinking of putting my house on the market, but if there's record low demand, should I really do that?
So I know folks on the radio can't see my glasses. They are not rosy colored. However, I wouldn't say we have record low demand within the county. I would say our demand is healthy. You know, when we see employers like the Andersons and Marathon doing good things regionally, that drives our local economy. And where the economy goes, housing follows. So our housing within the county, within this immediate area, is still strong. There is still demand, and you can still sell successfully for a reasonable price.
So let me ask you about a couple of additional data points that are coming today. As we mentioned, we're going to get the latest figures on new home sales and the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. For those who are not, you know, into the weeds on all of this, when they hear these numbers reported, what do we take away from whatever those numbers will tell us?
Well, typically what we see nationally, again, isn't necessarily an indicator of what's happening here within the county. It's important to talk to the agents here within the county to have a better understanding of how the market's moving. And it's exactly why you and I are talking this morning.
Right.
If we don't have those conversations, then as a consumer, we're going to sit back and clam up and say, my goodness, I can't sell or I can't buy. We can.
And as we've talked about in the past, a prime example of that is the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. And you talk about what goes into that. It's actually a composite of what the 20 different markets around the United States, none of which are the size of Findlay and Hancock County. So,
right.
You know, that may or may not be. It's designed to be sort of reflective of the national metric as a whole, but it may or may not reflect, you know, be a good reflection of what's happening here locally.
There are trends in those reports that we see eventually that come to us. But at this point in time, our market is still healthy. Is it moving at the NASCAR race? It was moving during COVID. No.
Right.
Is it a sloth? No. It's moving at a good, healthy pace right now. And if you are thinking about putting a home on the market or you're thinking about buying, this is still a time when you can do that successfully, regardless of what the national trends are telling you.
Yeah. Let me ask you for your take on one other data point that came out last week, and I'm just kind of curious, and that was the Home Builders Housing Market Index and their optimism for the future. It did tick up a point from the previous month, but it's still 35 on a scale of 100. Anything under 50 is considered pessimistic, and 30, so 35 is not a great number, even though that it's one point higher. What do you make of that, and how concerning is it that the people who are out there building the homes, and we've talked about, you know, shortage in housing, that the people out there building homes are not really feeling it right now?
Well, you know, 35.7% of all statistics are made up. And so I think when it comes to confidence surveys and things like that, again, we have to look at who they're surveying. We are seeing, we don't see the building here like you see in large metros. We're a tertiary market. So we don't see large tract developments the way you would in Columbus or Cleveland or Cincinnati. The three C's are totally different markets. Mm-hmm. Here, when we see new construction, it's generally one-offs. It's that local builder who's building a custom home for someone, not typically a spec. It does my heart good as an agent to see new construction because I know that we are around 7 million units short across the whole country. And again, it depends on which data set you look at, but we're millions short. We need this.
Yeah. And with respect to that, obviously in the news locally have been a couple of multifamily unit developments that have been making headlines, and most folks are familiar with that. Obviously, it's not directly impact you because these are rental units, multifamily rental units. But is that a good thing? I mean, does that eventually kind of have an effect on the housing market?
It does. There are, if you think of the housing market overall, there are rungs on a ladder. People right. start at the bottom rung as a rental, perhaps move up into the next price point. Anytime you have rentals, particularly higher end, it can lead to folks moving up into the housing market, which mm-hmm. in turn allows others to buy up or to make that next change. So it is never harmful to have it.
Yeah. And obviously, we've talked about the housing shortage. Anything that puts more housing units into the mix has got to be a positive thing in the larger
Absolutely.
Sense.
Yes. Yeah. We need the balance.
Brian Witta with us from Coldwell Banker Flag City, kind of breaking down some of the housing numbers. We'll get more of those today. Brian, thanks very much for the insight. We appreciate it as always.
Thank you.
Well, if you follow the news, you know it has been a summer full of natural disasters, one right after the other from coast to coast. And while we often talk about preparedness for your home and your family, how ready is your business to weather the storm? As these disasters get more costly, many small businesses become more vulnerable. And joining us are Jennifer Pippa, Vice President of American Red Cross Disaster Programs, and Rob Glenn, Vice President of Global Resilience of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation. And Jennifer, let me start with you. Talk about this partnership between the Red Cross and the Chamber Foundation to help small businesses better prepare for disasters.
Well, we at the American Red Cross know that preparedness does, in fact, start at home, both with individuals and families. And when they take steps to prepare, they're better able to protect themselves and recover more quickly from disasters when they strike. The exact same model applies to small businesses as well. And that's why we chose to partner with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation to help small businesses strengthen their exact preparedness, to help them think through how would they plan to deliver their business should their power or their communications infrastructure be interrupted? And how can we help small businesses better connect with resources that can support their direct recovery when an emergency strikes?
Now, Rob, this would seem like this should be a no-brainer, that you should prepare for, you know, these types of emergencies, these eventualities, because chances are good at some point you're going to deal with something along these lines. So why is it that so many small businesses are still relatively unprepared for a disaster?
So at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation, we recognize small businesses are the backbone of every community and our country, and that's why we're working with the American Red Cross to better prepare small businesses. And small businesses, because they're so vibrant, part of our economy and our communities, they're juggling everything. And that means they struggle with preparedness. They don't necessarily know either where to turn. About 66% of small businesses never really look up where to find information, and 69% of small businesses have taken no preparedness steps. So it really comes down to, I think, a perception issue that it costs either too much time or it costs actually too much money. And the reality is that, you know, based upon the risk that's out there, including, you know, in and around Toledo right now, you just have to look at the headlines that you just cited. That should be a call to action. And as Preparedness Month, it starts September 1st, it's a really great time to bump preparedness up on the priority level for small businesses to, you know, really take a look at where they have the opportunity to build some resilience and be part of the community solution when a disaster actually happens.
How often do you find that businesses and entrepreneurs think they are more prepared than they actually are?
Sure. So you have to be incredibly confident when you start a business.
Yeah.
America's, is based upon pioneering, right? So there's a great amount of overconfidence. We've, done some research. 94% of small business owners think that they're going to be okay on the other side of a disaster. That's actually not the case. We know that I think 36% are not able to make their payroll just a month after a disaster. And so that's incredibly important for small businesses to be thinking about how they're going to address that payroll cliff, really, in terms of keeping and retaining their staff, which is so incredibly important for keeping your business moving forward.
Now, Jennifer, I want to ask you about this Ready Rating program. Is that kind of the mindset that you're trying to combat there, that, jolt of reality to bring people back down to earth who may be more overconfident than than the reality suggests?
It is. It's just like Rob said, this is it's a free preparedness program that we co-developed with the Canadian Red Cross. But this is really to get to the heart of the problem. It's to help small business owners understand what their most likely risk is. So they don't even have to be climatologists. They don't have to be meteorologists. We can help them understand what their biggest risk is and then actually have them run through and take a test right then and there. Do an assessment. If a disaster were to happen tomorrow, how would that impact your small business? And then connect those small business owners with tools so that they can start thinking about continuity plans, about how are you going to take care of your employees, and how are you going to make sure that your small business is back up and running, because community members are going to look to you as a leader and a small business owner to be able to help drive recovery in your local community after a disaster.
Fair point also to make that while the natural disasters that have been in the news certainly grab the headlines and get your attention, doesn't necessarily have to be environmentally related. I mean, it could be a fire. It could be, any kind of disaster that we're, that's a disaster is a big word.
It is. And it's important for small businesses to be prepared for that. It could be just disrupting power to your business or sure. that block that your business is on for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
That can be a disaster for a small business. Understanding that and how you can pivot and respond is critical for the success of your business.
So, Rob, what are the disaster preparedness steps that you recommend that small businesses take?
Well, 27% of small businesses saying they're just one disaster away from shutting down permanently after a disaster. The first thing that a small business should do is really understand their risk, right? I think as we just heard, it doesn't have to be a really large billion-dollar disaster. It could be a smaller disruption, but you have to understand your risk. You have to look at, based upon the risk, how and where should you update or back up your data and your business records? Offsite or on the cloud, reviewing your insurance coverage, again, based upon risk. And then how do you communicate? You have to communicate to your employees about where you are in terms of being prepared for disasters, what to do if. Mm-hmm. And then also how to reach out to your key suppliers and also your customers about what to expect. We created a program, Ready for Resiliency. And this is a checklist that a small business can consult to start them on their preparedness journey. Doesn't cost anything. It takes under 10 minutes to take a look at that. And you register for this. And so when a disaster actually does happen, a qualifying disaster, a small business can receive a $5,000 grant if a disaster hits. And so that means that they can potentially have some additional capital when they have a disruption. And that can go right back to helping meet payroll, helping clean up, whatever they need to do in order to be open for business. And the best way to find out more is to go to ready4resiliency.com.
So very important, as you mentioned, the small business is really the backbone of any community. So making sure that they are prepared in the event of any kind of disaster, the what would happen if is so essential. Again, Jennifer Pippa is Vice President of the American Red Cross Disaster Programs. Rob Glenn, Vice President of Global Resilience at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation. Again, where can we get more information on this partnership, this program through this partnership?
For free preparedness planning, you can go to readyrating.org.
Thank you both for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
A man is accused of sneaking into the Big Cat Country enclosure at the St. Louis Zoo. Zoo officials say the man allegedly climbed a fence and onto a barrier of artificial rockwork above one of the habitats late Saturday afternoon. That doesn't strike me as a particularly bright thing to do. These are not domesticated animals. I mean, they may be in a zoo on display for public observance. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're just sweet kitties. Apparently, other visitors notified security of the breach. Security took the man into custody, turned him over to police. Although, it strikes me, now that I'm thinking about it, that had they done nothing, that's a problem that really would have taken care of itself eventually, right? I didn't even think about it. We're not going to do anything. We'll let you suffer the consequences of your actions. Elsewhere in the broken news, a Japanese father is in trouble with authorities for leaving his young son alone on Mount Fuji after the boy grew too tired to continue climbing. The 48, not dad of the year here, the 48-year-old man abandoned the 7-year-old at roughly 8,100 feet up the mountain on the trail at around 4:30 in the morning on Thursday. He told the child to wait while he continued up the mountain, up the trail with his older son. We're going to keep on going. You just stay here. We'll be back. A park worker found the boy alone on a bench about 3 hours later and alerted police, who located the father near another ranger station and ordered him to go back and get his son. What are you doing? Go back. Get your son. Are you crazy? Apparently, rain and fog had begun moving in when the child was discovered. The boy was uninjured and eventually reunited with his family. The father apologized for what he described as a rash decision, but police called the abandonment unacceptable and reminded hikers that you need to plan around their slowest group member. Plan for your slowest group member. Don't just leave your 7-year-old on a bench for 3 hours and say, oh, we'll be back a little bit later on. Not a good plan there, no. And finally, in the broken news this morning, the story of a 24-year-old man in Seminole County, Florida, who was arrested after destroying what he believed was a police surveillance camera. It turned out, though, it was just a decoy. Evan Meyer, dressed in all black and wearing gloves and a face mask, used his father's pruning shears to knock the device off its pole and smash it. What he didn't realize is that the camera he destroyed was a fake, and his vandalism was caught on the actual functioning camera nearby. He told police that he was uncomfortable with flock cameras and had been hearing all the negative things about the misuse of such cameras. That still doesn't give you the right to destroy them and to destroy the fake one while the real one was recording all the while. He has been charged with 3 felonies and released on $7,500 bond. Oops. That's bad luck right there. There you go. That is today's broken news report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled program.
The Finley Trojans play here on WFIN. This is Tim Montgomery. Join me and Coach Cliff Hite for all the action of Trojan football. You'll get every exciting play each Friday night, all season long, home and away.
This is Coach Stephen Adams. Up next, on Friday night, the Trojans are at Lima Senior.
The Trojans play here on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. Is nepotism a bad thing, or is it fair game to use a family connection to get ahead? A new YouGov poll of 1,100 U.S. adults finds 42% consider it good to use personal contacts to help a family member or friend secure a job. 42% say that's a good thing. However, 64% say a hiring manager should choose a more qualified stranger over a personal connection, even one who is qualified to do the job. So I guess it depends on what kind of role we're talking about with respect to nepotism. Some 78% believe that professional connections are very or somewhat important to career success. Experience with networking is widespread. 42% have helped a contact find work, while 37% have personally benefited from such help. But one in four Americans say that they have missed a job opportunity because someone else used their personal connection. And that's another part of this that is reflected, I think, in the survey. When you ask, is nepotism a bad thing? Most people say it's fine. If it benefits me, it's not so fine if it benefits someone else, which I guess is to be expected. But that's kind of interesting. One in four say that they've lost out on a job opportunity because someone else stepped in using their personal connection. Of all of the career fields where nepotism is most prevalent, people believe that politics tops the list at 83%, followed by business in general at 82%, and acting and entertainment at 78%. And we certainly see that all the time in Hollywood. Medicine ranked the lowest of fields where nepotism is most prevalent, with just 46% believing that it is common in that field. And I would hope that it is uncommon in that field. I don't know if you heard this, but I am told that Starbucks rolled out their fall menu today. So that means pumpkin spice everything is here. I don't know if you're a big Starbucks, but I'm not a big Starbucks.
No, person, I am not.
So, okay. But that's what I am told. And so it's I guess
not, I'm surprised they waited this long because I mean, I think one September. I mean, for some people after 4th of July, it's like fall season. To me, like September's got to hit.
Well,
and then I start getting the fall stuff out. I'm more of a traditionalist and take each season holiday as they come.
I do understand. It does seem like after we get to the 4th of July, it seems like summer feels like it's over in many cases because kids start getting involved in things and all of that. And it just is a race to back to school from that point. But it's still August and I'm not necessarily ready for pumpkin spice everything and, you know, the fall, you know, the full fall takeover yet. I do realize that we're into back to school and we've got football games and all of that. But the point is that late summer is a really great time to be out enjoying the outdoors. And what better way to do that? Get out into the parks. Michelle Rumschlag is here from the Hancock Park District. What's going on in the month of September? What do we have coming up?
Well, lots of activities. And again, for all information, you can go to the website and it's hancockparks.com. Mm-hmm. And then as you were talking of like countdown to September, coming up September 1st is our new season of Hike It that will be posted on our website. And so we'll have new trails for people to hike. And so if you're going, okay, what's this? And I'm familiar with it.
Explain what that
let
is.
Let me explain. So this is our, gosh, I think it's maybe our 12th year that we've done it. And so what we do is I put together hikes within our parks and then the surrounding village parks. So we always go out to Fostoria and hike around one of the reservoirs there. Sometimes we head up to Macomb, to Benton Ridge, and then just look at, you know, again, coming up with hikes. You can stop by the office and get a packet or go to the website and there's a little chart and explains what paths there are. And then you have between September 1st and the end of November to hike it. There's no, nobody needs to sign off. It's just on your own accord that you hike, and we give you 11 trails and you have to do just 8 of them to be completed in our eyes. There's also going to be maps because I don't always follow our traditional trails. I kind of make up my own within the parks. And well, I got to keep it fun that way. You can maybe get to different areas. And then if you complete them, you can bring them to our office and we have a medallion for you if you want. And we had a new design last year that I was very excited about. So we took that, just tweaked a few things on it. So we'll have some new ones available for people this year. So again, and if it's your first time doing it, we do have hiking sticks available if you like. And again, those are free of charge. You just need to stop by the Park District office for that. So again, beginning September 1st, all information. And you've got 3 months. And what a better time than the fall to get out in the parks. It's not as hot, maybe not as buggy. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be muddy like in the spring. It's a great time to go out and maybe take you to other parks and places you haven't been.
Exactly. Exactly. Discover new places to explore. And again, once we get into the fall, you'll start to see the changes of the colors and all of that. It's just a wonderful time to be out in the parks. So
definitely. Just want to put that plug out there for those that, you know, I know people have been calling and asking, but September 1st was that information hits the website.
Okay. And that is a free program, right? You don't have to.
It's totally free. Yeah. Okay. You can, again, print things off, download them off the website, or we do have some paper copies at the office if you want to stop by on East Main for us to pick those up.
Good deal. What else is going on in the month of September here?
Well, coming up that first weekend on Saturday, September 5th, we're having an insect hike. Out at Riverbend Recreation Area, meeting at the parking lot there by Shelter 3. And like you said, late summer, right? Still warm. September is still summer until the 22nd.
That's
I know people hit September and figures it's the start of fall. But there's still a lot of insectivity happening. So we're going to take a hike, look for monarch butterflies, see if any cicadas are calling. This starts at 10 o'clock. It's an all ages free. There's no registration. But again, great time to, you know, early September. It should still be nice and warm to get out. Maybe see a little bit of that fall color starting to happen, but looking for insects at 10 a.m. on Saturday, September 5th.
So Labor Day weekend and a perfect time. You go out and do the hike, go home, have your little backyard cookout and everything. You got your day set there. What else have we got to talk about coming up in September?
On Sunday, September 13th, our McInnes House Open House is happening that day out at Litzenberg Memorial Woods. This takes place from 1 until 4, and September's theme and topic is quill and ink. So going to be talking about writing letters. Of course, their quills, they would have had some metal wood quills, but majority would have been using feathers, so from geese or animals from the farm, turkeys. And then the ink. So again, you could have probably bought some at the store, but making it out of walnuts or other pigments. So learning about all the facets that go into ink and quills and letter writing will be taking place throughout the house there and in the workshop.
Out
at Litzenberg.
It is so fascinating to think about how different life was back in that era. I mean, we talk about self-sufficiency today. That is a whole other level. I mean, when you had to create your own writing utensils and your own ink, I mean, that is just such a, you know, that's a blow your mind type of concept, I think, for a lot of folks, especially young people.
Right. When you go to the store and just buy those things today and they're very disposable.
I can buy, I can buy a dozen Bic pens for 99 cents. And
but it's things that you already had. So if you're getting feathers from your turkey and your geese, they're on the farm and then you have them as a meat source. So it's not like they're just there for your quills.
Yeah.
Your walnuts, you're getting your wood out of your walnut trees, obviously your walnuts to eat. It's cooking down the husk of the walnut to make your ink, but it's also a dye. Mm-hmm. So you're getting many uses out of those items. It's just, you know, what can I get from this tree, from this animal, and using it in many different ways.
And that's another thing that's a completely different mindset for our disposable society today is they really didn't throw away anything that they could avoid. I mean, they used every single bit of every single thing they had. So
Right. Really. And it's multi-use where for us, right, not just disposable, but I only need it for one thing.
Yeah.
It's fine. I don't need it to do different uses.
Like all of the tools in my toolbox.
Different mindset. Different mindset in the 18.
All the tools in my garage that I've bought for one thing and never used for anything else again. Anything else to highlight in the month of September?
Something coming up for adults at the end of the month on Sunday, September 27th. We're doing a Woodland Forest Tea out at Litzenberg Memorial Woods. They're in the activity barn. It's taking place at 2 o'clock, and adults is ages 16 and up. We just need you to register by that Friday before with $15 per person. So this is, again, as the name implies, you're enjoying tea in a forest-like setting and then having some nature-inspired foods. So you're going to have some acorn kisses, forest moss cake, tomato mushrooms. You get the idea of having a fun with our food. And then you'll also be able to make a nature woodland centerpiece to take home. So some good food, sign up with a friend, have some good company, get to take home a centerpiece on Sunday, September 27th at 2 p.m.
All right, very good. Some of the highlights, but again, the full list of all of the programs and events and activities and everything else going on to the parks is at the website once again, right?
Yes, hancockparks.com.
Very good. Again, Michelle Rumschlag with the Hancock Park District with us. You know, a preview of late summer / early fall stuff going on in the parks. Michelle, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Visit us online at goodmornings.net. And if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would also appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating review on your favorite podcasting platform. That will help others discover the show as well. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.